Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating. Today we'll be talking with Matthew Robertson, author of Purusha, Personhood in Ancient India, published in 2024 by Oxford University Press. Welcome to the New Books Network, Matthew.
Thank you for having me, Malcolm.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So your book's topic is the concept of Purusha in Vedic and pre-classical Sanskrit and Pali texts. The term Purusha is usually translated into English as person, as your subtitle, Personhood, suggests. So maybe we can just dive in and ask, what's going on with this concept of Purusha? What's your main goal in exploring this concept? And why did you think it was an important concept to explore?
Yeah, sure. So Purusha is a book that asks, what did it mean to be a person in ancient India? Or what did personhood mean in ancient India? And to answer this question, I took a really close look at the many meanings and transformations of the Sanskrit term Purusha, which, as you mentioned earlier, is the closest cognate term to the English word person. In order to get at this, I set my sights on a span of time stretching from the period of the Vedas, so 1500 BCE, until the onset of the classical period of Hindu traditions, which I put a limit at 350 CE, essentially. And I focused especially on the textual traditions of the Vedas, the Brahmanas, the Upanishads, early and middle, the Pali Canon, the early texts of Ayurveda, and then finally the Mahabharata. And the reason for that was these were the sources that seemed to me to have the richest data on the Purusha concept. Now, what I found is this: throughout the domains of ritual, society, politics, asceticism, yoga, Buddhist meditation, medicine, devotional religion, and then just literature, generally speaking, there's been a sustained understanding, a functional worldview, and a paradigm, I think, that persons are deeply confluent with the world, and that what it means to be a person is much closer than we might actually initially imagine to what it means to be a person, to be a world, excuse me. Personhood, as I put it in the book, is worldhood. And the world around us is a fundamental part of who and what we are, or might be, as the case sometimes is. This all starts with the simultaneous cosmological and political aims of the Vedas, where priests sought to honor and regenerate a cosmic person, styled originally, I contend, on the god Indra. But it soon develops into a really complex history of conceptual frameworks, practical regimes, technical apparatuses, and humanistic pursuits, all of which seem to find common ground around the attempt to swell, expand, and extend the reach and scope of a person in one or another fashion, to try and bring them into a concordance with the world, and thereby to effect a transformation that is empowering, liberating, healing, and in one sense or another, in line with the truest and most fundamental nature of our existence as persons. I think my hope for this book is that, given the nature of this argument, that this book ends up challenging us to re-examine some of our assumptions about the nature of ancient Indian religions and the persons who lived them, and thereby to try and spark some new ideas and conversations regarding the interrelated nature of persons and the world in which they live.
Hey, thanks. So what got you interested in the topic of this book?
It started not organically, as a lot of these projects normally do. I was reading through the texts of Ayurveda for the very first time. And at the same time, I was reading lots of scholarship that was problematizing the nature of bodies as closed systems. I can say more about that here in a little bit, but in the midst of reading Ayurveda, I came across a phrase in the fourth book in the fifth chapter of the Charaka Samhita, which is one of the foundational works of Ayurveda. And a very small snippet of text, it says, Purusha Loka Samhita, which I translate as the person is the same measure as the world. I take a really literal approach to it. Now, this is a phrase that's been translated repeatedly in many, many different ways. Usually taken as a sort of affirmation that the human person is a microcosmic replication of the macrocosmos. But the more I studied Ayurveda, the more it became really functionally impossible for me to accept that reading. Ayurveda has a tendency to imagine the human person as deeply embedded in the world of their concern. This broad world that's composed of five elements, space, air, excuse me, space, air, fire, water, and earth. And there's this perpetual give and take between the embodied person and the environment at large. And it seems that Ayurveda is pushing us towards an understanding in which we should see ourselves as not simply embodied beings who have a closed system that is addressed by medical practice, but rather as these really expansive open systems that are constantly sort of coming into a kind of identity relationship with the environments in which they dwell. And this is the basis of health or sickness, whether or not they're in confluent concordance with their environments, or if they are in some way in a friction with those environments. I took that as a starting point for rethinking what I saw as the precursors to Ayurvedic thought, because Ayurveda is really sort of a genius level science that deals with not just medical systems, but it tries to incorporate really the entire history of Indic tradition before it. And so I just had to ask myself the question, is it possible that Ayurveda has gotten this more right than we as scholars have when we look at these more ancient traditions? So I wanted to go back into the texts and look at what they say about persons and purushas and see if I could figure out ways to elevate the idioms of Indic personhood and begin to problematize our sort of reflexive imposition of Western subjectivities and worldviews on these texts. And to me, the idea of a microcosm is fundamentally one of these impositions. There are no Sanskrit terms for the word microcosm within the Indic traditions. There's later terms that get introduced, like the Pinda Brahmanda pairing that you find within tantric texts, but it's such a late addition. And even those framings and formulations dealing with the Pinda and the Brahmanda, they've been problematized by scholars as well, David White being foremost among them. So trying to elevate those idioms of Indic personhood, and then to try and see how the antecedents to this pre-classical worldview of Indic personhood that I'm discovering within the Ayurvedic texts, I want to see if we can trace this historical through line to them. This gave me an opportunity to explore the paradigms that were operative during really critical periods of ancient India's societal transformations. And it brought me all the way up to the threshold of the emergence of those dualistic systems of Hindu traditions that are most famously laid in stone by such thinkers as Ishvara Krishna and Patanjali in their classical works on Samkhya philosophy and the yoga tradition. Something really drastic happens in those texts where the identity relation that's forged in Ayurveda very clearly, but also I think very clearly in the preceding traditions, it gets inverted, it gets spun on its head. Really critical here is the Sanskrit term samanya, which means identity, essentially, in the way that Ayurveda uses it. But when we, so the relationship between the person and the world is usually described as one of these samanya relationships. The person has a relation of samanya to the world, and the Sanskrit term that gets used there for world is primarily loka, which I think means less of an objective space and more of a kind of subjective locality and experiential horizon that we dwell within. When you get to these thinkers at the classical era, Ishvara Krishna especially, he says that the person is fundamentally not equal, nisamanya is the word that he uses, to the world, and he styles the world as prakriti, of course, the material sort of nature of reality itself, different from the consciousness that he identifies with specifically this concept purusha. So I wanted to know what led towards that transformation of thought within Indic traditions, and I believe that Ayurveda gave me this sort of a starting point for thinking about it for the entirety of all pre-classical forms of Indian traditions. I think I'd add one more thing. There's one of the motivations that really sort of drove this project towards its fruition was a court case in 2017 that took place in the state of Uttarakhand, where the High Court in that state came to the conclusion that it was an absolute necessity, legal, social, and spiritual, to declare the rivers Ganges and Yamuna, the surrounding ecologies, the glaciers, and the like, to declare them persons so that they could have legal standing as a recourse for protections from corporate polluters and from other forces that would somehow damage these ecosystems that have ultimate sort of, you know, reverberations and feedback loops that lead towards the deleterious effects on human health. So I wanted to understand how we got to this place in India where we have a kind of modern scientific and Western understanding of what the environment is, a space that we can exploit and use as an object for our own concerns and needs, and what had happened to Indic thought that led us to led Indians to sort of deny and reject this notion that the world is part of who they are. So those were all the motivations that I was thinking about when I dove into this project.
Great, thank you. So let's take the book in sequence, and we'll lead up to the chapter 6 on Ayurveda, which is sort of in many ways the culminating kind of, bringing all of this together. But let's go back to the start and think about the distinction between self and person, because this is a distinction that you draw the reader's attention to early on, that this is an important, these are two important concepts, in English, self and person, that should be distinguished, and also that you're going to tackle Atman and Purusha throughout the book as well. So maybe let's just start. What is the difference, as you understand it, between self and person, and why is it important to sort of appreciate the relationship between these concepts?
Yeah, I guess I should start by saying that there are many places within Indian traditions where the distinction between Purusha and Atman is not clear. In fact, there's a clear conceptual overlap and sometimes a direct identification of these two terms. But generally speaking, Frederick Smith is really sort of on the point with regard to this in his book, The Self-Possessed. He points to the idea that the self has a tendency to sort of reduce itself to a metaphysical substrate. Right, this thing that persists beyond through bodies. And in that regard, we can think about the Atman in a manner that sort of allows us to disconnect it from the materiality and the physicality of the world. Personhood seems to be something that either includes or subsumes or adumbrates this concept of personhood, but it more commonly has an ability to sort of subsume the natural and the material world itself. And that's the sort of basic framing that I took to heart when I was writing this book, that personhood is fundamentally something that has to do with the way that we are, as living embodied beings, engaging with the environment of our concerns and our habitual forms of action. And the Atman, of course, is unaffected by those habitual concerns and actions. That's what gives it its sort of vaunted and transcendent status within traditions like the Upanishads. But personhood is continuously shaped by its surrounding environment. And so, yeah, those are the distinctions that I try to operate with primarily throughout this text.
Great, thanks. I think that's important to kind of set that out at the
Yeah, thank
outset.
you.
You mentioned this a little bit in your introduction about why you got interested in this topic, the time period that you cover. So, roughly 1500 BCE to about 350, 400 CE. That's a very long time period, right? You
Yeah,
touched a
yeah.
little bit on how you selected the text that you're working with, but I thought maybe you could say a little bit more about your methodology, about how you selected what you worked with in the book. I'm imagining you looked at more material than
Yeah,
is presented in the book. Yeah, maybe
absolutely.
just talk a little bit about your methods there of selecting and engaging with texts.
Sure. I was looking for those texts that seem to say sustained things about personhood, generally speaking, that deal with the concept of the Purusha at length and give a kind of snapshot into the broader trends and patterns that we find within the various traditions that we can trace throughout those first roughly 2,000 years of history. Generally speaking, there are many different ways that the word Purusha is used within traditions. Often it can be used in a general sort of like the way we would use John as a sort of basic sort of designator of a human being or something like that. And so there's a lot of uses of Purusha that really don't deepen our understanding of what personhood could possibly mean, at least not in any sort of interesting academic ways, we could say, right? But generally speaking, the texts and traditions that I dealt with, they're the ones that seem to take Purusha as a subject that needs to be expanded upon and delved into with some great depth. So my methodology was built around the use of various text mining software and apparatuses. So just seeing where these condensations of uses of the word Purusha appeared and then turning towards those portions of text as a possible source to draw from. Now, ultimately, what ends up in the book is much less than what I looked at, as you mentioned. There's simply way too much to say about this concept of the Purusha. It ultimately came down to what I saw as this thread that's tracing throughout these traditions, these patterns, and these elements that seem to repeat over different traditions and morph as those traditions shift and change. So it ultimately became a sort of winnowing based on what was most fruitful and most exciting to me personally, honestly, as well.
Great, thanks. So let's start with chapter two. So we talked a little bit about the main concepts in chapter one and the motivations in our lead up here. Chapter two focuses on the Rig Veda and in particular the Purusha Sukta, which is the famous song of the person. But in that chapter, you start out with Agni and Soma and Indra.
Right.
And so a reader might wonder, or a listener, why start with Agni, Soma, and Indra if you're wanting to talk about the Purusha Sukta?
Well, the fact of the matter is the word Purusha is incredibly rare within the Vedic texts. The Rig Veda itself, I think I've forgotten the number, at 17 uses seems to be what I recall right now. Very, very small. And the vast majority of those uses appear within the Purusha Sukta itself. And the Purusha Sukta is a late addition. I stand with Jared Whitaker on this question, a late addition to the Rig Vedic tradition. It seems to date less to the era of 1500 BCE and closer probably to somewhere around 1000 or 900 BCE, roughly coincident with the emergence of the Kuru hegemony as a new political organization within ancient India. The Kurus were a tribe that came out on top in a kind of struggle between various clans for dominance throughout northern India. And when they came into power, they seem to have a political reason to reformulate their understanding of sovereignty. And they gave their sovereign a new name. Prior to this moment, sovereigns in a Vedic era clan would refer to their, excuse me, sovereigns would be referred to as Indras among men. That's the name for the chief. But when you have essentially an Indra above other Indras, something closer to a president over governors and states, then a new designation becomes almost a necessity. And it seems to me that the Purusha Sukta is a document that really tries to reground the politics of Vedic India and give a new ascendant title to someone who is above and beyond all those prior formulations. Now, of course, the Purusha of the Purusha Sukta is styled simultaneously as a cosmic entity that is the power that governs and structures and also is the content of the world itself, and simultaneously becomes a model for the human person whose duty it is to act as the sort of vice regent or the overseer of those spaces that the capital P person represents. But it's this relationship between persons and worlds, between Purushas and Lokas, that had me go back further into tradition and try and understand, well, what is this Vedic understanding of the world, of the Loka? And inevitably, when you look at that concept, assuming that it has this fundamental identity relationship with the concept of a Purusha, you just inevitably end up at the figures of Indra and his relationships with Agni and Soma. Because these three figures represent the cosmology and the cosmogony of the Vedic worldview. To me, I fundamentally see in the Indra story his battle against the constrictive demonic serpent force named Vritra as the central cosmogonic and cosmological narrative of the Rig Vedic tradition. And it tells a story of the god Indra getting ready to protect the world from this constrictive force that seems to be constraining and actually shrinking the expanse of the world, but also cutting off the life-giving forces that the people rely on, which we can think of in terms of the weather patterns, but more generally just the life-giving patterns and forces that seem to be operating in the cosmos. By constricting them, Indra is called into action. He brings the gods Agni and Soma over to his side, and in so doing, he takes on their qualities and their characteristics. Agni gives him this fierce might that is also fiery and brilliant. And it's not the kind of light that we should identify simply with the body of the fire, which of course Agni represents, being that igneous deity par excellence, but rather the entire scope of the light that spreads from that fiery surface. The substratum through which that light spreads, the Vedic tradition understands it primarily through the lens of the god Soma. We can imagine the fire in the heavens, the sun coursing through a blue sky, and the Vedic Indians, they seem to look at that blue sky as if it were a watery substrate that doesn't extinguish that fire, but rather gives it a surface off of which to reflect and refract and to spread throughout the whole world. So by taking the powers of Agni and Soma into himself through a ritual practice, Indra is fundamentally making himself solar and world-sized, right? As large as those powers themselves expand throughout the natural world. And that's precisely the power that he needs in order to break past the constrictive force of this demonic serpent named Vritra. Ultimately, sketching the Vedic view of the cosmos through the mythology of the Indra-Vritra tale gave me, I think, new interpretative tools to deal with what I see happening within the Purusha Sukta. So it looked as though Indra provided the prototype and the template for the development of this concept of the Purusha at large. It's a circuitous path, to be sure, but I think it makes much more sense out of this sudden and shocking appearance, truly, of this concept of the Purusha in the Purusha Sukta.
So just to touch on, kind of follow up what you were saying earlier in terms of your intervention in this book, in the existing scholarly literature, one of them is to push against the idea of the person as a microcosm of a macrocosm. Do you
Correct.
see that in this Purusha Sukta? Do you read this differently in terms of the macro microcosm readings?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, the Purusha Sukta tells the story of the ritual dismemberment and rememberment of this original cosmic person, and the parts of that person are the parts of the world. It's very difficult for me to see anything within that Purusha Sukta as affirming a microcosmic replication of this person. The person's whole sort of, excuse me, the cosmic person, this Purusha Sukta person is one who's continuously expanding and extending throughout the entirety of the cosmos. So there's a line in there that says that one quarter of the Purusha exists here in the realm of the mortals, and the other three quarters exists up in the heavens. But this Purusha is constantly expanding through the way that he takes in food, the tradition says. And we can see this as a general metaphor for the way that a human sovereign is not meant to see himself as a replication on a microcosmic scale, but rather as someone who expands themselves to the scope of the entirety of the realm over which they oversee and exert their power. That cosmic sovereign, I'm drawing primarily on the works of people like Theodore Proferes and his Vedic Ideals of Sovereignty and the Poetics of Power, and then Jared Whitaker's Strong Arms and Drinking Strength, both fabulous books for getting new insights into the Vedic tradition. What we see here is a paradigm and a practice that's being instantiated in which the human sovereign, their role is not to embody in a human form this cosmic person, but rather to swell themselves up to an identificatory scope and to become equal to this cosmic person at large.
Great. Thanks for clarifying that. So let's turn to chapter three. Chapter
Great.
Three turns to the Brahmanas, where you're arguing that the focus shifts in the conception of the Purusha to a Purusha as human sacrificer, but you point out that there are still places of connection with this Rig Vedic conception of Indra, in particular in your understanding of the concept of Loka, often translated as the world. So maybe you could tell us a little bit of what are some of the key transitional elements about the way Purusha is understood in these texts, where there's places of contact with the pre-existing conceptions and also opening up sort of new spaces and conceptions of Purusha.
Yeah, absolutely. The through line I think that you see in the Brahmanas most strongly is the transference of this solarized identity of the person, where the sacrificer, as the case often is, usually the human sovereign, is essentially trying to identify themselves with that solar scope. That seems to be a direct through line from the Vedic tradition. The means by which they carry out this identification become incredibly complex. They become part of the sort of motor of the ritual apparatus that's described within the Brahmana tradition itself. I see a couple of themes that really emerge in this transformative development. The theme of measurement rises to the fore, this notion that a person needs to measure up to the sacrifice, and the sacrifice is itself the same measure as the entire world. We have a tendency within scholarship to frame these sacrificial experiences and these practices in terms of microcosms, macrocosms, and then the ritual space becomes a mesocosm that sort of navigates between the two. And I think the basic idea that you're using the ritual space to sort of communicate between this cosmic scope and the human side of the equation still holds. But if we focus too much on the microcosm and macrocosm element, then we miss the expansive movement that's taking place within this tradition. To give you a sense of what I'm talking about here, the Yajurvedic tradition that is most well represented within the Brahmanas spends considerable amount of time talking about the orientation and the measurement that goes into building these ritual enclosures. Most famous would probably be the Agni Chayana rite, which involves the building of a five-layered altar that is shaped like a bird, and the bird is meant to be a representation of the sun. Each of the five layers is made up with a just huge number of bricks, all of which represent different parts of the world, beings within it, but also forces that are operating and things like that. And in the course of building up that altar, you're building up a kind of encyclopedia of what the world is, right? Now, interestingly, the actual measurement of that ritual space is based on the ritual, excuse me, is based on the measurement of the human sacrificer that is at the center of these practices, the one who's going to be transformed through that ritual into a solar persona. That measurement is not meant to replicate the cosmic measure at large, but rather to take that human measurement and reconfigure it, rethink it, almost through like a mathematical equation operation, right? To create this sort of fractional equivalence, right? Between the human person who has this embodied shape and the larger scope that we're slowly sort of building out of the true meaning, in other words, of the measure of the human person is the measure of the world at large, because the ritual space is the true measure of the person, and the ritual space is itself the measure of the world. There's lots of really interesting technical devices that come into play here. One of my favorites is the use of the gnomon, which is a stick in the ground for a sundial that they used in order to orient their ritual enclosures towards the sun, because they wanted to create this sense of correspondence and direct equivalence as practically as they could, right? Now, this gnomon, this stick in the ground that becomes the basis of a sundial, it's known within tradition as a parusha. Right. And it's roughly 12 angulas tall. I can't do the conversion math for exactly how tall that is, but it's a short stick in the ground, so to speak. You use that stick in the ground to trace the measurement, the movements of the sun, and catch its movements so that you can understand what a proper east-west orientation line would be that will allow you to line your ritual enclosure up directly with the sun. So you're sort of building on this sense of getting the sacrificer to make this identificatory leap between their own embodied self and the cosmos at large. That direct correspondence between the parusha as the gnomon and these measurements that lead towards this collapsing of difference between human persons and cosmos seems to me to be a really interesting and insightful way of thinking about the relationship between human persons and the world at large. This would all be an empty exercise, however, if there wasn't an experiential aspect worked into this. And I think the other element that you see within the Brahmanas is this sudden elevation of a consideration of death at the center of the ritual proceedings. There's a really wonderful myth that sort of gets the purpose of why death is important to these ritual proceedings, and it has to do with the birth of the sun. The Shatapatha Brahmana, one of the ritual texts that gives sort of rules and steps and patterns for how to carry out these rituals. It tells the story of the sun's birth from a goddess named Aditi, who ultimately gives rise to a series of children. And the last of those children is named Martanda. Martanda is a name that translates, interestingly enough, as dead egg. It's an aborted child, essentially, that we have here. And it's malformed. It's not shaped the way that it should be. And Martanda's his siblings look upon him and say, "All right, we've got to save our brother here. We've got to do something to rescue this child from this aborted state." And so they perform rituals and they try to bring Martanda back into the shape that he is supposed to be in. Now, we would think that that shape is nothing other than the orb of the sun in the sky traversing through the heavens. But in fact, the brothers and sisters, they say to Martanda that this shape that we're giving you is in fact the shape of a person. So we have this immediate overlap within the Brahmanas, which becomes a sort of point of speculation and interrogation within the Upanishads, where we have a non-human form being identified with the sun, and the concept of the Purusha being fundamentally and primarily identified with the solar fiery body of the sun. Of course, the sun is not simply the orb in the sky, it's the extent of the light that spreads throughout the entirety of the world. And so the myth seems to tell us that there is a ultimately a human shape to the cosmos at large, which of course plays into the prior tradition's understanding of the cosmos being a capital P Purusha. The human sacrificer in relationship to myths like these is urged within the Brahmana text to undergo their own kind of death and rebirth transformation, where they overcome their identification with a human form and come to a deeper understanding through their rebirth, through this encounter with death, with the cosmos at large, so that they too can become solar and fiery in their own understanding of themselves.
Right. So what you just said a couple lines back, mentioning the Upanishads, I think is a nice segue
Oh, good.
between the Brahmanas and the Upanishads, unless there's something else that you wanted to add to that discussion of that chapter.
Oh, there's endless little details that sort of work out, right? The way that this near-death encounter plays itself out. I suppose if we're going to turn towards the Upanishads, we would be remiss to not mention that ultimately what we're seeing here is the development of the Brahmacharya at the center of the initiative practices that need to go into this practice of sacrifice. So one of the ways that the sacrificer has a most direct encounter with death in the sacrificial realm is to undergo a process of asceticism that involves exposure to great heat, fasting, isolation, and the like. All of these can be sort of looked at as we can look at them as procreative metaphors where you're isolating yourself as if you're a child in the womb who's getting ready to be reborn. But direct experiential aspect of this involves bringing yourself physically very close to a state of I'm not going to make it. And the ritual sort of rebuilds you in a new understanding of yourself. And Brahmacharya, which is the practice of Brahman, and then the most sort of direct translation of that term, becomes this practice of expanding oneself, which is one of the ways that we could most directly and etymologically translate this concept of Brahman, that the ascetic, as they're initiating themselves into this ritual space, what they're practicing is to become an expanded identity. So maybe we can leave it there and jump into the Upanishads from that, I suppose.
Good. That's helpful because within the chapter, this is your fourth chapter, you focus on the Upanishads. And of course, again, in terms of scope, there's no way that you can address all of the Upanishads. You focus on sort of early and middle texts. And these are probably some of the more famous texts for sort of lay people that discuss personhood and selfhood. People know about it already. So there's a lot to unpack in this chapter. And I thought maybe one angle into it would be to talk about the crisis of samsara that you identify as impacting the worldview of these texts, sort of thinking about the forces that are underlying the Shramana age and these practices, some that you've already hinted at, others like yogic practices that play a role in the conception of Purusha that develops in these texts, which of course range over a long period of time.
Yeah, I suppose we should start by saying that the Upanishads, they don't represent a single tradition. And when I think about this, it becomes really shocking to me that we tend in our classroom experiences to go directly to the Upanishads as an introduction, because it really throws students into the deep end if you really do due diligence about what these Upanishads represent. It's a vast corpus of competing and contradictory texts in a lot of ways. And so it's just trying to figure out what the Upanishads are saying as a whole is quite a difficult task. Trying to understand what they say about personhood is equally difficult because you have these competing and contrasting, contradictory notions of what personhood is. This sort of explosion of a multiformity of tradition that comes in the Upanishadic era is tied ultimately to the historical period that we think of as the second urbanization. And in that time period, India is shifting away from a tribal and semi-nomadic lifestyle towards a more sedentary, agriculturally focused, and urbanizing kind of world. In the urbanization of the world, it seems that though there were many people within Indic society who were thinking that maybe we need to go back to the way things were. We need to touch base with these insights that were core to who we were at the beginnings of our society in India. And it seems that in their attempt to explore these original ideas, they left behind some of their urban spaces. They began to wander throughout the natural world. And in so doing, they had to divorce themselves from the larger political and social concerns that drove the notion of personhood in the Vedic period. The Vedic period really tries to style the notion of personhood as something that is fundamentally about sovereigns. It's not about you and I. We are not persons, according to the Rig Vedic tradition, especially. That changes fundamentally within the Atharva Vedic tradition, especially. And the Yajurveda seems to be a tradition that draws in those Atharva Vedic approaches to this concept of the Purusha. But by the time of the Upanishads, you have people trying to understand what it means to sort of develop an identificatory relationship with nature and with the world at large in a manner that doesn't ultimately lead towards a political ascendancy that makes one capital P person that rules over the rest of the world and all the beings and the forces that are operating within it. So they have to navigate this individualized understanding of personhood. And in that navigation of individual personhood, you start to come to, I think, a more direct experience and understanding of what it means to be an individual actor in the world, someone whose actions have fundamental consequences throughout society and the world at large. And of course, this develops into what we see as the sort of underpinnings of the Upanishadic world, the samsaric worldview in which karma is driving an embodied soul that is ultimately identified with this self that is the self of all beings that we call the Atman, or simultaneously we can refer to it as Brahman. How does this individual sort of aspect of the Atman come into its own? And then after coming into its own, come into an understanding of its universality, right, throughout the world. And so we're navigating karma as a means of trying to overcome those limiting factors that stop us as individuals from coming into this totalizing realization of who we are as persons. That seems to be a really important part of the historical development that's going on here. We're responding specifically to this transforming of the social and political world of India and the literal material transformations that are taking place as the Indic world becomes more and more urban. And these spaces that we think of as wilderness spaces become increasingly other to those urban spaces that most of us as persons spend our lives within. So I see them navigating continuously this, what does it mean to be an individual who is striking out in the world and trying to come to a deep understanding of what the world is that we come from and that we must continuously interact with, and starting to answer those questions of how it is that we can act in a manner that no longer separates us from that world at large, and that brings us into a deeper and deeper confluence and concordance with the world at large.
Great. So maybe, again, there's a lot in this chapter and there's a lot in the Upanishads as a whole, but maybe you could pick out one or two texts or section of texts that you found especially rich in terms of understanding Purusha in this broadly Upanishadic context.
Yeah, absolutely. There are many things that we could point to. I think the one that my mind goes back to repeatedly is the concept of the Svaloka, one's own world is what it's called. And it's this notion that each of us has a fundamental duty, a necessity actually, as persons to come into a deep understanding of what it means to have our own loka, our own world. Now, my initial sort of sense of what this means is that we're thinking about, you know, persons have these spaces that we're continuously moving through. There's this horizontal awareness that we're constantly embedded in, right? And we need to understand what it means for us to carry this world with us. When you dig deeper into this text that deals with the concept of the Svaloka as well, which is in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, I should say, I think it's the fourth section of the first book, you get this notion that what it means to be a person is much more about the actions and less about the awareness that you carry into the world. The notion of the Svaloka is something that needs to be sort of delved into and responded to directly. The passage in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad tells us that if we leave this world without knowing what our own world is, then it's like a rite that hasn't been properly performed. Or a meal that's been left uneaten, I think is another way that the text puts it. So we really need to dive into what this concept means. And it tells us that we understand our own world by performing acts specifically for others, by understanding that our own personhood, our own existence is fundamentally tied to these interactions that we have with other beings in the world. I think it provides a really sort of interesting ethical kind of intervention against those who are at this time and period, perhaps living more and more selfish and self-oriented lives as the Indic world becomes increasingly urbanized, right? We lose scope of our broader understanding, our place within the seasonal vacillations that are taking place in the world at large. And so the text tells us that we need to feed our ancestors with rituals. We need to feed the gods. We need to take care of the livestock that are under our charge. We need to care for our neighbors, right? We need to do all these kinds of things. And by doing so, we come to understand that our world is a world that gives worlds to others. This is a really fascinating idea to me, that the idea of being a person is something that has a kind of demand built into it, a necessity for us to give worlds to others. And so to be a person is to be someone who continuously tries to give those worlds to others through various different kinds of acts. This kind of understanding plays ultimately into the way that the Upanishads try to reformulate how procreation works, and specifically the relationship between fathers and sons. Because, of course, we're dealing with a patriarchal text, androcentric. The notion is that a father gives a son life, but by giving that son life, they give the son a world to enjoy. And so when a father looks at a son, they look at someone who is continuing their own enjoyment of the world that they're experiencing. And when a father comes towards the end of their life as they're passing away, there are new ritual means that are developed and explored most prominently within the Upanishads, where they discuss the possibility that a father can, perpetuate his own worldly enjoyment and existence through his son. It's called the rite of transfer, and it appears in a couple of different Upanishads, Brihadaranyaka and the Kashitaki, I believe. And in both of these texts, the notion is that a father is passing away, son comes up to them and says, I will take your life into mine, to put it as simply as I possibly can. And in so doing, you can live on through me. Now, of course, there's a parallel sort of narrative that's taking place where a father is ascending up to a heavenly space afterwards called Svargaloka. And Svargaloka is the loka, the world in which the sun goes. That's how we can break down Svarga. And that's Theodore Proferus's analysis of that term. So there's a kind of doubling and expanded extension of the father's presence simultaneously at the cosmic level when he becomes identified with the sun in the afterlife. And then in a more human register, a continuance of this broader phenomenal landscape that persons experience through their awareness as he carries on his existence through his son. That's one avenue we could look through. There's plenty of others that maybe you want to point towards for us to talk about.
Yeah, I guess one thought I had was about the connection between yogic practices and these ritual practices. I mean, a big and complex terrain, but we've been
Absolutely.
thinking through these ritual practices, the human sacrificer, the ritual patron, the yajamana. In the Upanishads, you point out the role of yogic practices in terms of kind of personhood. Maybe you can touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. There's plenty of different ways to go about this, and it all is quite complex. So I'm sorting through my mind what is the easiest one to get across right now. I think I'll go back to where almost all sort of discussions of yoga and the Upanishads start, and that, of course, is the Katha Upanishad. Now, the Katha Upanishad is structured primarily around that ritual that I mentioned earlier called the Agni Chayana. It involves a narrative framing involving a child named Nachiketas, who is, through a very strange series of events, sent to Death House to have an interaction with death. It involves a sacrifice that his father is carrying out, and it seems that the sacrifice isn't going very well. And essentially, Nachiketas, one way we can frame it is that he offers himself as a better sort of victim in the sacrifice, we can say, right? In having this confrontation with death, Nachiketas, which is a name that means one who does not know, he's going to get an education. And the education is going to lead him towards two understandings of the world. The way that death frames it is that there is a person of three fires and a person of five fires. Now, the five fires designation refers to the reincarnational cycle that's laid out within the early Upanishads. This is the most technical sort of approach to how the way that reincarnation takes place. And it essentially says that when a person dies, their body is placed on a cremation pyre. Some essence rises up out of their body and then traverses the heavens up to the sun. If they have liberated themselves from karma, then they will enter into the sun and become one with this cosmic expanse. But if they are destined to be reincarnated, then they are retrojected out of that solar sphere, sent to the moon where the gods feed on them for a time. And then ultimately, the essence of that person who's passed away then falls through the digestive sort of means that the gods have wrought. They become rain that falls to the earth. The earth is watered, and the plants that eat that water become the food that we then eat. The food that we eat then becomes the basis for the reproductive fluids that are within our body, and a person is reborn within that manner. So that's one way we can understand this expansive, temporalized understanding of a person as they move through the cosmic apparatus. The three fire model has more to do with the relationship between the human being, the sacrificial sphere, and the solar heaven above. And you're trying to build, much in those ritual terms that I was alluding to earlier, this broad identification between the human being and the cosmos at large through the sort of mediating factor of the sacrifice. Now, this text, interestingly, finally, in the end of its sort of course, turns towards yoga as a different way to try and understand how this process works. And very famously, the Katha Upanishad gives us the analogy of the chariot, the person as a chariot. It also gives us the sort of earliest formulations of a series of hierarchies of constituents of the cosmos that we now recognize as the underpinnings of a philosophy known as Samkhya, which tried to enumerate and count all the different parts of the world and how they add up ultimately to this experiencing totality that we call the person. Now, a person is a chariot. This framing of the chariot poses this notion that the human being is made up of various different parts. The body is the chariot upon which we ride. The horses that lead the chariot, those are the senses that help us discern what we want to move towards in the world. They're the basis of our desires and our actions and the like. The reins are the mind, identified with the manas. The driver of that chariot is identified with the intellect, which is a higher order level of the mind, known as the buddhi. And then there's a rider in the chariot that's known as the atman. And of course, the totality of this is the person, right? Now, yoga becomes this practice whereby we sort of endeavor to use the intellect and the mind in order to sort of control the function of those senses so that we can move through the world more smoothly. The typical understanding of how this works, or the one that you see repeatedly throughout scholarship and interpretations, is that this requires a forceful checking in the way that we would hold back those horses, right? A restriction. And in some cases, it's been interpreted as a total sort of withdrawal of the senses from the external world. But when you look more deeply into this broader pattern of an expansive notion of personhood within the Upanishads, it becomes really difficult to sustain that interpretation. And instead, what it seems like we're dealing with is an attempt to become expert charioteers who can really take in the entirety of the scope of the world that we're dealing with and not be drawn by our desires towards the specific elements of sense that really draw us and that we're addicted to, right? That become the basis of our habits. Instead, we're trying to move freely and allow ourselves to sort of interact with those things in the world that are the basis of our purposes. I'm sure if anyone who has ridden a horse who's listening to this knows that if a horse sees an apple on the ground, it's going to go straight for that apple if it's got a little bit of hunger in it. And so ultimately, we're trying to make sure that our horses aren't the things that are driving us. Rather, we are the ones who are driving those horses. In so doing, we open up the scope of our awareness. By taming and mastering our senses, we become individuals who are far more ready to take in the entirety of the world and to make decisions, to sort of develop our actions and sort of manipulate our habits in such a way that we can be less stuck on specific things in the world and more able to turn ourselves more fully towards the world at large. I think there's a really telling metaphor that lays itself out at the end of the Katha Upanishad that says that the yogi who has mastered their senses, this yogi is free from distraction. This is the word that they use. And so in the same way that horses can be distracted by food they see on the ground, we want to make sure that we aren't distracted by the things that our senses are drawn towards. When we achieve this end of distraction, it's as if, according to the text, the yogi pulls a shining and bright thumb-sized Purusha, as it's sometimes referred to, out of our bodies and expose it, right? Turn it towards the outside world so that we shine more brightly upon the world at large and shine less internally, right? So we're really turning away from this internalizing understanding of who we are as persons and trying to turn ourselves more radically outwards towards the world at large.
Great. Let's take that and kind of shift to the Pali canon, because chapter 5 talks about personhood in Buddhism. And I mean, maybe a little bit of a connection with what you were just saying, because there's an emphasis on personhood and awareness. So as I understand your argument in this chapter, you're arguing that in the Pali Suttas, the personhood is a state that can be attained in some sense, and it's in some way identical with some kind of awareness. And this personhood attainment is crucial for removing suffering. So maybe two questions so we can talk about this chapter in a nutshell. One, what is it that characterizes the Buddhist conception of the person in the Pali Canon Sutta material in particular, in contrast to what we've been hearing so far? And then what's the relationship between personhood and removing suffering and awareness?
Okay, great. Yeah. So we need to say right at the outset that Buddhists are far more prone to rejecting the existence of persons. In the same way that there's a rejection of the existence of a stable and eternal self, the Atman, right? This is central to the Buddhist insight. And so my approach here is not to try and reverse and undo those Buddhist teachings, but rather to focus in Specifically on what the Buddha says when he does talk about persons, because the Buddha does continuously talk about persons. Now, we could point towards this distinction between ultimate and conventional understandings that the Buddha is constantly working with within the Pali Canon. And so ultimately, there is no person. But when we talk about the conventional reality of the person, then we're moving through the basic understanding of what a person is as we move towards the eradication of suffering and this final realization that there is no such thing as a person, broadly speaking. I turned towards the Chulasunata Sutta, which is the lesser discourse on voidness, as it's called. And it lays out a practice that I think gets at the heart of this movement from conventional understandings towards this ultimate realization that is identified with the liberating event of nirvana. When the Buddha talks about persons throughout the Pali Canon, however, he constantly refers to a person as a sort of amalgam of elements. This is usually four or five. Space is sometimes not included alongside air, water, earth, and fire. And when he talks about those elements, he has several different kinds of approaches to it. One of the approaches is to get us to understand that those elements that we identify with as part of our bodies, they're equally impersonal as those elements that we encounter outside of our bodies. And so we need to reconfigure our understanding of the elementality of personhood by coming to an understanding that the earth element that is within us is essentially the same earth element that is outside of us. And so we shouldn't have a sense of ownership or mindness connected with any one sort of aspect of the earth element. We should become detached from these elements. And this is part of the practice that leads towards that ultimate realization that there is no stable entity known as the person. Person or as the self. These element practices of sort of detachment and disidentification, they take a really interesting turn when we look at the Kasina meditation, which is a practice whereby you have some representation of an element in front of you. It can be as simple as a clod of earth or a colored disc that represents one of the four or five elements. And the Buddhist meditator is meant to develop a deep and absorbing concentration level on that object in front of them. They want to make that the whole of their awareness, as the text says. And in making it the whole of their awareness, they come to a state where everything outside of that space of awareness is voided out. It becomes shunya, right? Not a part of our focus. And we're continually filling ourselves with these expansive, meditative dives into these absorptive elemental experiences. So we can just imagine a Buddhist meditator sitting down looking at a clod of earth and forgetting everything else around them except that clod of earth. In so doing, they are filling the space of their awareness with that earth. And they find that that space of awareness that they dive into through this Kasina meditation becomes incredibly large. It fills everything, it reaches all dimensions and expands throughout what we would think of as the experiential space of the world, right? Now, as you deepen that meditation, you work through a series of incredibly difficult to understand and difficult to describe meditative states that are known as the jhanas, these meditative absorptions. But what I find really interesting is that at the end of these meditative absorptions, when you have attained that state of meditative insight that leads towards the absolute sort of recognition that there is no permanent self, there is no understanding of me and mine, but rather there is this eradication of identifying sort of impulses within us. That leads towards this freeing insight that there is only this dependently arising sort of sea of phenomena that are continuously rising and receding. When you come to that sort of understanding, you're retrojected out of those deepened meditative experiences. And all that abides at the end, according to the Buddha, are these perceptual extensions that are spread outwards. So the space of awareness that one who has attained nirvana experiences after attaining nirvana is now what abides after this culminating event. So I take that as evidence that when a Buddhist comes to the realization of what it really means to be a person, which is to say to be dependently arisen, impermanent, ultimately empty, and devoid of any sort of permanent self, the experience of that realization is not one that pulls the Buddhist out of the world. It brings them more deeply into a direct and immediate experience of the world. The way that the Buddha talks about this is that you're reformulating and reframing this event of sensory experience that he calls contact. All perceptual experiences involve the contact between a sense power, a sense object, and the consciousness of that sense object that emerges through that interaction. And it's this sort of coalescence of factors that typically, conventionally, leads us towards a sense that there are certain things that are mine, there are things that belong to me, and there are other things that are other than me. But with the sort of meditative insights that come through the practice of voidness, all sort of fabrications of me and mine are dropped in that event of contact. You're no longer drawn by attachments or desires towards one or the other. The event of contact seems to perpetuate and continue as this extended space of awareness, but there's no longer any projection of those false views, as the Buddha would put it, of self versus other. Instead, there's this simple abiding, okay? And it's in that space of abiding that the awareness of a Buddha sort of comes into its own.
Great. So let's, for the sake of time, press forward again. There's rich material here, but
sure.
We talked a little bit already about Ayurveda and the Charaka and Sushruta Samhita that kind of spurred your inquiry here. Chapter 6 takes that up directly, talking about the idea that the person is the same measure of the world, as you put it. Maybe you could just unpack that just a little bit more now that we've had some context. What does it mean to say that the person is the same measure of the world in these texts where at, you know, first glance, you might think, well, they're focused on medical treatments and dietary advice. How is personhood and worldhood interrelated in this context?
Absolutely. So Ayurveda absorbs from Buddhism, we could say, this elemental view of the world, but it does not receive the sort of ultimate negation of the concept of the person or the self. And so we're still operating in this world in which sensory contact is a fundamental basis of the state of our existence. Now, Ayurveda is famously focused on diet, but its approach to diet is expansive. Diet is not simply the food that you take in through your mouth. It's the consumptive practices that all of your senses are engaged in. As I look at you on Zoom right now, right, I am eating you with my eyes, so Ayurveda would say, right? When I listen to music, I am enjoying and eating that music with my ears. And in so doing, I'm taking in elemental realities that are going to have a fundamental impact on the way that my human system functions in its own elemental constitution. So we need to sort of control our diet, according to Ayurveda, such that we are taking things in that cause health, that bring a sort of stability and harmony, and ultimately, they would say, a sense of equality with the world at large. We don't want to overeat or undereat with our senses. We don't want to eat the wrong things. Of course, we could talk about drinking poison as a thing that will cause problem to your health. But equally, we could say, I've got an eclipse coming to my part of the world here soon. Staring at the sun in the middle of eclipse would be a bad sort of visual diet. These would harm my senses. And as a result, I wouldn't be able to take in those fiery, luminous elemental qualities in the world in the same way that I would if I harm those eyes. And that could lead me towards states of disease and illness. So we are in Ayurveda, not just sort of dealing with the concept of diet, we're dealing with the entire elemental reality of the human being. And by coming to a perfect diet, we could say, a diet that is, according to the text and the tradition, one that is equally balanced, one that is yoked equally, the text says. It uses the term sama yoga, right? This is what we're aiming for, this equal and balanced diet where we as embodied elemental beings are taking in right measure and at the right time throughout the course of the year, all the different elemental qualities that sustain and propagate our existence. So this means paying attention to both the spatial and the temporal realities of our existence. And to be a person is to be someone who fundamentally understands this environmental and elemental embeddedness within the material world at large. We want to eat the kinds of foods and take in the kinds of sensory data that is appropriate to the spaces in which we live. So a person that lives in a more desert type region is going to have a very different diet than someone who lives in the marshes of Florida, so to speak, right? These different diets are part of our own constitution. These environments become part of our own dietary habits. And so we want to try and eat a diet that is in balance, both with the location and, of course, with seasons, because the seasons are the ways by which those elemental qualities in the world are ripening into their own with a kind of rhythm and pattern that we need to pay attention to if we ultimately want to take in the right things at the right time. This is fundamental to how personhood is working and health is working within the Ayurvedic tradition. It's all about using the quote-unquote yoga of our senses to develop a more sort of balanced and even engagement with the environment at large.
Great. So for the sake of time, let's close by thinking about your last chapter on the Mahabharata, which you in this chapter connect to Ayurvedic thought and a lot of the materials that have come before. And you say that Purusha in this text has, you say, a veritable excess of meaning, that there's, it's just sort of a very abundant in the Mahabharata, construed as a text in the singular, and also the textual layers, which I don't think we have time to get into all of that level
Far
of
too
detail.
complex, yeah.
It's too complex. But maybe given what we've talked about so far, you could talk a little bit about the role of the Indriyas and restraint in personhood in the Mahabharata. That seems to pick up on some of the themes that we've been discussing. So
Yeah.
how do you see that in the text?
Well, so the Mahabharata is fundamentally a text that's speaking to everyone in India, but it's really trying to get everyone to recognize that there are patterns of behavior. If I can speak really broadly and paint with a broad brush about the Mahabharata, what kind of patterns of behavior are out there that create a world that won't descend into the chaos that the Mahabharata ultimately leads towards, right? The Mahabharata is a story of a great war between two rival factions within a family, and it's absolutely catastrophic. It's apocalyptic, in fact. And so I see the text as, at its most basic level, an attempt to sort of rectify how human persons work through the world in such a way that we don't tend towards those same moments in history, if we can, again, if we can avoid them. Now, speaking to the sovereign, the text seems to delight in the idea that the way that we can create politicians, right, who are better for the world at large, is to get them to engage in precisely the kinds of sensory yoga that you find first within the Upanishads and then leading towards the Ayurvedic material. Okay. By controlling the senses and restraining them, there's this paradoxical inverse reaction where the buddhi, as they say within tradition, the intellect swells like a fire that can reach every corner of the world at large. Bad rulers are those who are drawn by their immediate sense hungers and desires. They're selfish actors in the world. And in being those selfish actors, they have a tendency to imbalance the world by the imbalance of their own diets. Of course, their diets have a greater sort of impact on the world at large, because as goes the ruler, so goes the people that he has under his charge primarily. And so if we can get rulers to practice the yoga of sensory restraint, to understand that this world is not meant to be driven by desires, but by a broader understanding of the embeddedness of who we all are and how we interact with each other, then we can create a kind of shortcut to a more happy and prosperous political situation. Duryodhana, who is the sort of perennial foe of the entirety of the Mahabharata, is one who has incredibly sort of irascible tendencies and great hungers, primarily for himself. Now, he's sort of celebrated as a good ruler during his own time, but he doesn't have the stuff to lead the world away from war. And this is precisely what the sort of most central character in terms of the sovereign conceptions of the Mahabharata, Yudhishthira. This is the sort of difference between these two figures. Yudhishthira is continuously engaged in a practice of sensory yoga, navigating the world at large. And in navigating the world at large through this kind of sensory yoga, he comes to a deeper understanding of his relationship as a lowercase p person, we could say, with the capital P person who rules all things. And of course, in the narrativization of the Mahabharata, we have a name to give to that capital P person, and it's Krishna, Vasudeva, right? The god of the Mahabharata. Their relationship is a metaphorical sort of laying out of this negotiation that takes place between human rulers and the cosmic ruling forces. And of course, at the core of it is this notion that we need to not act with selfish intent, but rather set aside our own desires and act for the sake of the protection of the entirety of the world. And one of the primary means we can do that is by restraining our sensory yoga, and through that restraint, come to a broader expansive identification with the world at large.
Great, thank you. I really appreciate your taking the time to sketch this out again. The book has much more textual detail and discussion of all of these ideas than we've been able to touch on. But maybe I can ask you one last question here, which is what you're working on now that this book is out. What's your current project?
Absolutely. I've got many, many spoons and many soups right now, it seems. I'm continuing to delve into Ayurvedic theory. and pull more out of this new worldly personhood understanding that I feel like I've unearthed. Right now, I'm specifically looking at a theory of epidemics that's contained within the Charaka Samhita that gets really at the core of these notions of rectifying political figures, giving them a new means of approaching their office such that we can create not just happier, more prosperous societies, but those that avoid the kinds of mass casualty events that epidemics represent. It seems timely, obvious, a little bit late, but I feel like we're still working through these notions of how our own actions in the world are contributing towards events like the COVID-19 pandemic. So I'm trying to think through those. I'm pushing for the next monograph length project into the classical era and their understanding of the relationship between persons and worlds. And I really want to try and understand the causes and conditions that led towards this radical, utterly sort of upending insight that we find within the classical works of Ishvara Krishna and Patanjali, where the person is no longer capable of being identified with the phenomenal world of their experience, and instead is sort of turned into this isolating experience that is only directly identified with consciousness, never with the materiality of existence. So I want to understand how that happened.
Great. Well, thanks. I look forward to seeing your work, and I appreciate your time.
Malcolm, thank you very much for giving me this
Thanks.
opportunity to share my work.
Absolutely. Thanks.